From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the University of Michigan shuts down sports as a new variant of the COVID virus emerges among athletes.
The student coming back from the UK, which of course is a hotspot for the new variant, was not quarantined, obviously mixing with the city as well as the university, and that's when the panic starts, of course.
Also, shelters in Grand Rapids see an increase in the demand for services as the economic fallout from COVID pushes people out of housing.
We started to realize that there's not going to be enough room because we also cannot have as many individuals in our buildings.
Plus, new guidelines for vaccine priority cut off much of the supply of doses for the Upper Peninsula.
We know people are tired of hearing it, but this is a race against time now because that puts the virus ahead of our vaccine efforts, which are slowing down.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The new COVID variant is here. More on that story is coming up later in the program. But first, all of Michigan's counties have fewer COVID vaccine doses than they would like at this time. And it may be impossible to balance every region's needs with the available supply of the moment. But counties in the Upper Peninsula do face some pretty unique challenges right now. We're checking in today with Carrie Ott, Public Information Officer for the LMAS District Health Department, serving Luce, Mackinac, Alger, and Schoolcraft counties. That's the eastern part of the UP. Carrie, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, April. It's nice to be here again.
Generally speaking, how's the distribution process for vaccines going so far?
Well, it's going well. Initially, our distribution was more than we expected because of the way that Pfizer is delivered in 975 doses. And we had two hospitals set up to take ultra cold storage, so we had some Pfizer. And our hospitals and our health department have really done a great job of rolling out the vaccines we've been getting. The big change came last week when they announced that distribution would now be based on population. And so this week, as far as I understand, the entire Upper Peninsula did not receive any Pfizer vaccine. And LMAS District Health Department received a total of 600 doses for our four counties.
Mm. I want to ask more about that for sure, but can I ask, first of all, have the LMAS counties got to the point where people other than hospital workers and folks living in congregate care, like nursing homes, can make appointments for vaccination, or are you still just worrying about that first group?
Nope. Our 1A group was much smaller than in larger areas downstate, so we were able to get through that group very quickly. And we're ready when the state moved to a kind of a hybrid version of 1B, but pulling in the 65 plus group as well, and then prioritizing some groups farther down in 1B. So we were ready for that. And our 65 plus population, which is a little over 9,000 people in our four counties, they were very ready for vaccination. And unfortunately, that also hit at the same time that we found out we're not going to get as much vaccine. So it's going to take time to get through just the 65 and over population in our four counties.
I'm not sure this is a perfect description, but my understanding is that Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services has adjusted their decision-making formula based on this guidance from the CDC that has to do with social vulnerability that does take population into account. But to hear MDHHS tell it, they're also looking at factors like, what's the unemployment rate in a given area? How densely packed is the housing? How many folks might be in a situation where they're far away from healthcare resources? What have you heard about how the decision was made to send a radically smaller amount of doses to the area?
Yep, the social vulnerability index was a key part of what the CDC guidance included. And one of the factors in there was focusing on the areas that were initially hardest hit with COVID infections and also with COVID deaths. And that plays very closely into that housing situation where everybody's in very close proximity to each other. And that's a factor that really doesn't exist much in the Upper Peninsula. And we have not seen, we've got a lot of cases, we've had a lot of cases, but for LMAS total, so far we've had 11 COVID-related deaths in our four counties. So as the state put all of that into their formula, based on what the CDC guidance was, we end up with a smaller supply of vaccine. It makes sense. It's not easy to explain to people up here, and we are so appreciative that people want the vaccine, but it's hard because we had a lot to begin with, and now to have it brought down to such a low level, it's a little harder to explain to the public and even to our hospitals who got no vaccine this week. So there's some unique challenges.
So the doses that you do have, can you tell us a little bit about where those are being distributed and who's doing the work?
Well, the hospitals continue to vaccinate with a focus on the 65 and older population. As the state asked, we have done a considerable amount of our law and fire and CPS workers earlier. And then the hospitals also do have their second doses for this week for the groups that were due for those. They already had those and will be getting those out this week and again next week as well. Second doses will be provided. But a lot of first doses had to be canceled.
You know, Carrie, there were some frontline health workers in Michigan, in various parts of the state, who were, of course, very eager to roll up their sleeves when the vaccine was first available. And other folks had some hesitation about being in the first group of citizens to get the shots. Now that the state has started the process rolling and we have a new group of people who are getting the vaccine, I wonder what you're hearing about people's interest in getting vaccinated, how much demand, and maybe just sort of how the buzz is going in the LMAS counties.
Well, there's always some naysayers, never going to get this, don't believe in it, all of that. But for the most part, all of the feedback and the desire to get the vaccine has been very, very positive in our four counties. Been really impressed with the reaction and the desire to get on the lists, even knowing they may have to wait a while to get their vaccine. They still want to be in line and get that call when we have a vaccine ready for them.
Can you tell us a little bit about how things are going with infection rates and hospital capacity?
Well, we've noticed an interesting trend. As the vaccines rolled out, testing went down. We're not doing anywhere near as many tests currently as we were doing 2 months ago. What we do know right now is that we do have one county, Alger County, has got an incredible increase in cases right now, and they have since the 1st of January. From the first 2 weeks in January to the second 2 weeks in January, the number of confirmed cases of COVID in Alger County went up 80%. From last Thursday to the week before on Thursday, they added 30 new cases. That's a considerable increase in counties that are small, and our other counties are mostly flat. But again, because not as much testing is happening, we're not sure on how accurate that might be. And the 11th, and I could be wrong on this actually, we may be at 12 deaths now. I remember we did have a conversation yesterday that we will be adding a 12th death confirmed COVID in our district.
The state numbers show that as of Monday, 8,650 vaccines had been distributed within the district. Do you have a sense of whether that's you're pretty close to all of those having been delivered at this point? Meaning to say, do you have a sense of how many of those have been administered to people at this point?
About 60%. That's based on the numbers on the state website as far as administered. I know it's actually higher than that because it takes several days to log all of those vaccine administrations into the state MICR immunization website. And we had an event, a large event on Friday, and one of our hospitals had a large event on Saturday, both for that 65 and older group. And so I'm guessing we're down, that's probably at least 500 doses not showing up on the state website, possibly more. The issue now right this minute is not as many people are being tested.
Is that a function of how many tests you're able to deliver or just where people's attention is in this moment?
I think it's more of where people's attention is and the hope that they see in vaccine. And so when they get something that could conceivably be a symptom of COVID, they don't get tested. They're not thinking of it. And because our drive-through testing events, it's a little, you know, it's 12 degrees in the Upper Peninsula. It's a little hard to do those big events right now with that. So we're not rolling out any large testing events either at this moment. But there are plenty of places where people can be tested. With this new strain that's in lower Michigan that is more infectious, we know people are tired of hearing it, but this is a race against time now because that puts the virus ahead of our vaccine efforts, which are slowing down because of vaccine supply. That means people have got to redouble their efforts to wear cloth face masks appropriately over mouth and nose. Stay home when you don't feel good. And please don't gather with people you don't live with. It's an unpleasant message. I'm tired of hearing myself say it, but we have to do it. We have to protect our healthcare capacity and to protect lives.
Carrie Ott is with the LMAS Health Department in the eastern part of the Upper Peninsula. Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, April.
We'll be right back after a short break. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In a little over a week, Michigan has gone from zero reported cases of the B117 variant of COVID-19, first discovered in the UK, to more than a dozen confirmed cases. We know it's spreading. The question is, can we still contain it to clusters, or has it become widespread in Michigan's population already? Here with the latest on what we're seeing in pockets of spread is Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Hey, Kate.
Hey, April.
So as of this afternoon, how many confirmed cases of the variant do we have in Michigan? I mean, and do we know where they are?
Yeah, so the update that we got yesterday, Monday afternoon, from the state was 17 confirmed cases. 13 of those are in Washtenaw County, where we first detected the first case last week. And then we learned yesterday that another 4 cases have been confirmed in Wayne County. And on top of that, there's another 4 close contacts that have tested positive for COVID in Wayne County, and we're waiting to know which variant there is. But like you said, there is likely more cases that we just have not detected yet. And that's simply because of how hard it is to detect this. You know, we do tens of thousands of COVID-19 tests every day in the state, something like 37,000 on average right now. But we only sequence a teeny tiny fraction of that. So I think sometimes people have this perception that when they go and get tested, like somehow in the test results, there's, oh, it's this variant of COVID-19. The tests only tell you whether or not you have a virus or not. It doesn't tell you which variant it is. And that has to be done in a very small number of labs. And it can take a really long time. So detecting this, is there's going to be a lag.
I read that international travel is connected to at least some of these cases. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so really very little at this point. We know that on January 16th, we had our first confirmed case. It was an adult in Washington County who officials say had recently traveled to the UK, where, of course, this variant was first detected. We know that two cases in Wayne County are also people who traveled internationally. We don't know where they went. One person has already left the country again. And we don't know how many of these additional cases are linked to this travel, if at all. You know, some of them, there doesn't appear to be any link, especially in Washington County. So again, that gets back to the question of, do these all go back to like specific travel cases, or is it just that now, as we're doing more detection, we're starting to see that this variant was already out there in the community? And that's the big question right now. You know, can you contain this with good contact tracing, good testing, quarantine, isolation, or has this basically become a much wider spread already and we're just now picking it up?
Kate Wells has written an article about this that's on the Michigan Radio website. Kate, you wrote in the article that there's a race against time to track the spread of this variant. Can you explain what officials are up against?
Yeah, it's one of those things where we need to be making decisions about this on a public health level pretty much right now. We just don't have the data to do that. So whether we find more of this variant or not, it's not going to change what an individual should do, right? So like it's not going to change the fact that you should keep wearing a mask and social distance and participate in contact tracing. What it can change is essentially, for some of these counties especially, you know, do we reopen indoor dining, which we know comes with its own risks, as is scheduled to happen on Monday? And the problem is we just don't have enough data to be able to answer that question yet. So over the weekend, for instance, Washington County put out this alert and said, hey, we've learned that there was some public exposure in some pretty public places, a Meijer and a mall. And if you were there during these times, please come and get tested. And then it took about 350 of those test samples and sent them up to the state lab. Well, it's going to take a week to know whether any of those samples contain the variant and how many. And the county, when I'm talking to them yesterday, you know, they want to do at least a couple cycles of that to try and get an understanding of how widespread this is and if they need to take more steps. But again, it's going to take a couple of weeks. And by that point, you know, when we talk about indoor dining will have reopened for, you know, a week and a half. So it's this real tension between, it's just going to take more time for us to get the information that we need. And also, every time is really important here, and we don't have a lot of it.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you, April.
A little later in the show, we'll talk about the new variant's impact on the University of Michigan, where the greatest number of cases to this point have been confirmed. With the temperature well below freezing, this would be a dire time to miss rent payments in any year. But the job losses and stress of COVID-19 are combining to pose a huge challenge for people living close to the edge and for those trying to fight homelessness in Michigan's communities. Starla McDermott is the development director at Guiding Light of Grand Rapids, which provides housing and recovery services in the city. Starla, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for welcoming.
So when you think about where the shelter stood at this time last year, how different are things right now?
Oh, completely different. March is when things started to change, but in January and February, I think my boss had an inclination, but we were just normal business as usual with our programming. We had a back to work program and recovery program. And yeah, at this time last year, no idea what it would be like today.
Yeah. How is it? Are things different just in terms of the number of people who need help? Or is there something different in the composition of who's experiencing life in the street right now?
It's actually, there's several different things have changed. Number one, because our number one goal is for the current clients that are in our building, our responsibility is to keep them healthy. And so it's a lot harder to do intakes because we're getting people tested before they come in. So it takes longer to keep individuals or get individuals into our programming. And then once they're in programming, we're actually really limiting their ability to be out and about. So they're doing programming, they're doing virtual classes, virtual AA meetings. They're somewhat locked down and safe and healthy unless they're going to work and then they come back in. The other piece, though, that we've noticed is that there is an increased need for shelter and for housing. In Grand Rapids, we've been seeing the tent cities growing along the river in Hartside Park. And so we started to realize that there's not going to be enough room because we also cannot have as many individuals in our buildings, not just us, but Degage, who's also in the Hartside neighborhood, Mel Trotter, because of social distancing, we cannot house that many people. So we realized we were going to have to find another shelter solution to keep people warm and safe in the winter if they chose to come inside.
Yeah. Such a perfect storm between the distancing that's necessary to deal with COVID and the increase in population that needs your help right now. Would you say that you're seeing a different population, maybe in terms of more first-time clients?
Yes, yes. I mean, there's definitely some of the normal clients who choose to be outside, who do not want to come in, but the individuals who are going into the temporary shelter that we worked with to open with Mel Trotter, it definitely is some new people. We are also at Guiding Light, because we have a recovery program, we're seeing an increase. We had 17 inquiries of individuals looking for long-term recovery. The statistics have shown that liquor and alcohol purchases had skyrocketed since last March. And I think we're just beginning to see that those trickle of, you know, down effects of individuals who are now really suffering from their addictions and asking for help.
Yeah, as much as there's been a ton of joking among those of us who are not in recovery and who have a roof over their heads, that sounds like a very dire situation.
Yes, yes, yep.
Would you say that you and the staff feel you have been able to accommodate the increase?
We have so far. The temporary shelter that we opened can accommodate 100 people. We can do more, but that would be meaning laying down more mats and things like that. So we have beds for 100 individuals. It's three floors, so one for women, one for men. We have not met full capacity there yet. So we do have that availability if we need to bring in more mats. But thankfully, we've not hit that part yet. We did, I think, hit about 80 individuals stayed there a couple of nights ago.
There's been a fair amount of controversy over the city's decision to clear people out of the encampment at Hartside Park and to move them into overflow shelter.
Yep.
Is there room for both options to exist, or are there solutions that we aren't thinking about yet?
Well, I think the number one solution is housing, and we're trying to tackle that. Again, that's another expense. Mel Trotter is kind of managing the day-to-day processes over at 250 Ionia, and they do have individuals that will meet with homeless and help them find housing if they want to do that. But if they don't want to do that, and the reason a lot of them, I think they don't, because they want to be in their community and their people and their friends. And that's when they're opting to have little camps together. No, I don't think that if that's what they want, I think that should be fine. And I think we should be able to then arm them with needed items to stay warm if they do choose to be in a camp. But we did want to also give the option if somebody does want to get out of the cold that they have somewhere to go. If we did not have 250 Ionia, they would not have had that place to go.
What are the ways that you think about helping people who aren't willing to stay overnight in a shelter? I mean, you said make sure that they've got things they might need, like socks and I'm assuming blankets. But what's Grand Rapids' situation with mobile units? Are there enough providers who are out there helping folks who maybe don't come in?
There are the Homeless Outreach Task Force, which is kind of coordinated by the fire department. They do go out and check on people, encourage them to go into housing if they can. I know in the summertime they were handing out water and things like that. We have been partnering with other organizations like Heartside Ministries and going and picking up shoes. Wolverine has been donating shoes, and we will go all the way up to Howard City and pick those up and store those at Heartside Ministries for individuals to come. We have given the task force some items in the summer, you know, things like that. We do also hand out coats, boots. We do require new items now because of COVID, but ice or ski gloves, not just regular gloves, but ski gloves because they don't get wet is really popular. So there's just different organizations that are gathering these items so that if an individual does need them, they can go and pick them up. And then, of course, the Homeless Outreach Task Force is going around checking on everybody.
Starla, how hard is the pandemic making it for people to get back on their feet right now? I imagine that there aren't that many people who are willing to let go of supportive housing if they have it.
You know, what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing is it's the pandemic is affecting individuals that are a lot lower income. I think people that have better jobs or the higher income bracket, I don't sense that they're being affected as negatively as individuals who are in that low income. I did meet a lady the other day who she is newly homeless and she was in the restaurant industry, a bartender, and unemployment isn't enough, you know, and the moratoriums for evictions were put off, but she was not on the lease. And so she had to, you know, get her roommate kicked her out. So I'm seeing it more new people, women I'm seeing, and definitely more low income that are being impacted, I think, harder with this pandemic and employment than most people.
Do you have any sense of how the pandemic is affecting the traditional rental market, the, you know, the lower cost places where folks might stay?
You know, I don't know that. I know that we are trying to buy more housing, and that's been a little bit more difficult than we thought, because we don't want to sit there and have a bidding war for apartment buildings. You know, because we do have housing, we call them Iron House, and we have 32 apartments. We're trying to get another 7-unit building so that we can get people through programming and get them into housing. But the market is really expensive to buy. I don't have an answer in regards to rent, how that is, if it's harder to get people into rentals. Rent is super expensive in Grand Rapids. So I can't imagine that it's very easy for somebody who has been evicted or who has had a job loss to be able to afford or get even approved into, you know, an expensive apartment that's in Grand Rapids.
What about the issues of substance abuse that people might be dealing with? Is the pandemic making it more difficult for people who may have had a relapse or maybe have never been in a program before to get to meetings or find meetings that are appropriately distanced or conducted over media?
Yes, that is definitely. One thing when you are going through recovery, community is really important and you need support. And everything is pretty much virtual right now. So that was another goal, was us to really try to build a nice, tight-knit community for the clients that are in Guiding Light so that they don't lose that sense of just feeling lonely. We need to, you know, make sure that they feel like they're part of something. And it's hard because AA is completely virtual, and sometimes even the therapy now is completely virtual. We're getting a lot of inquiries, but we really think that it's going to really be more noticeable after the eviction and foreclosure moratoriums come lifted, because a lot of people can hide their addictions when they're kind of being sheltered at home. So we do feel like there's going to be an issue with evictions, and a whole bunch of people are going to be out on the street, but there's going to be people who are then going to also be reaching out for recovery help. Even the different Pine Rest, they're not at full capacity for detox. People are not reaching out just yet. So, which in turn, even though we're getting some intakes, we could be at full capacity and we're not right now in the recovery program that we have.
Another thing about evictions is that they can do real damage to someone's ability to find secure housing down the road. Do you think about the kind of impact the pandemic and subsequent evictions are going to have on people's housing security, even after we get COVID under control at some point?
Yes, I believe that 2022 is really going to be hard on a lot of people. And that was exactly why Guiding Light went from being a traditional shelter. We went through more programming, and we have the Back to Work program, and we have the recovery program. In 2008, when we had, you know, the economy issue, there was a lot of homeless individuals then, and there weren't jobs. So what Guiding Light did is they created Back to Work, in essence, as a safe place for individuals who have just hit rock bottom, have been evicted. They probably have bank accounts that were overdrawn and a lot of fees, so they can't even get a bank account now. So then they can come into Guiding Light and have safe housing, not worry about getting meals, and can stay there for 120 days and work with counselors to get a job, number one, and we'll help you find work, but then save your money and start tackling those different things and stay with us for 120 days, stress-free, so that you can tackle those things, evictions and bank issues and credit card issues that would prevent you from getting a lease and getting approved for a lease. And that's what we did in 2009, 2010. And I think that's really what we're going to have to do again at the end of 2021 and into 2022 is just be solely focusing on helping individuals tackle that debt so they can get into housing.
Starla McDermott is Development Director at Guiding Light of Grand Rapids. Starla, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
In a moment, Ann Arbor is one of the first places where the state's B117 cases are showing up. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We got the unpleasant news last week that someone affiliated with the University of Michigan tested positive for the COVID-19 variant B111. She had just returned from a trip to the United Kingdom. Within a couple of days, doctors confirmed two more cases of the variant out of the U of M. The Washtenaw County Health Department has shut down Michigan's entire athletic program after a few confirmed cases of the variant among student athletes. With us to talk about what we know on the spread of this virulent strain of COVID-19 is John Eubacon, Michigan Radio sports commentator. Hi, John.
Hello, April.
Now, do we know exactly how many confirmed cases there are of this variant within the athletic department right now?
We don't. My sources, unofficial, tell me it's a handful because a few other athletes were very quickly contaminated also. And then likewise, the student athlete in question went to Myers on Saline Road, went to Briarwood. So, of course, the county is understandably concerned. The surprising thing here for a university, especially an athletic department, that has been one of the most careful in all of college sports throughout the fall, was one of the least careful in this situation. The student coming back from the UK, which, of course, is a hotspot for the new variant, was not quarantined, obviously mixing with the city as well as the university. And that's when the panic starts, of course, not without reason.
Now, is there something here that might tell us about the path of contagion? I would expect maybe a team to get shut down. But this is the entire department. I thought most Michigan athletics were at least somewhat siloed within their own practice facilities. Do you have any idea what the crossover is?
Some good candidates include U.S. Arena in the morning. There's a little pickup breakfast you can get there, bananas and muffins and so on, where all the athletes often mingle. The Academic Center is another place where they all get together. And of course, there's a fair amount of social mingling amongst these various athletes. They all tend to be friends. So there are a lot of possibilities.
The decision to shut down sports came from the county health department, not from the university. Have you heard how the university's feeling about that decision?
Well, it's sort of yes and no. The county gave a very strong recommendation. These days, I think the state government is very skittish about laying down hard and fast rules, of course, because people do protest and whatnot. But it was a very strong suggestion and a good one. And Michigan wisely took it. Look, they're not thrilled at all, of course. And I cannot imagine right now an athletic department anywhere in the country less eager to shut down their season than University of Michigan. Right now, the men's basketball team is number 4 in the country. The women's team is 12th. They're having the best season in the history of Michigan women's basketball. And the men's hockey team is currently 8th in the country, and they're all on winning streaks. So I suspect this is a deeply unpopular decision in the department, but I think unavoidable.
John, the University of Michigan's athletes, or at least a whole bunch of them, got together to put out a statement. Quoting here, based on the department's testing policies, placing healthy students in quarantine is unnecessary and excessive. they say that it should be taken on a team-by-team basis.
Right.
I mean, I guess that's true if we're talking about a facilities problem, but if the contagion was more from, you know, socializing, that could be a different thing.
So in a nutshell, they basically make your point, April, earlier, which is that the teams are largely siloed, more now than they were even 10 years ago, because where the coaches used to be all in the athletic department building, now, you know, track is on South State Street, tennis is up there as well, you know, baseball, softball, they're all basically separate with their own offices, their own facilities, often their own weight rooms and so on. But there's enough interaction in the academic center, at Yost Arena in the morning and other places, socially, of course, in dormitories or in their houses, that crossover is a concern. I get where the athletes are going with this, and they work very hard. The odds, perhaps, if you had no contact with this person, are pretty slim. But this new strain is somewhat unknown, as you know, and it seems to be far more virulent, far more contagious than the normal strain we're already dealing with. So, of course, Michigan is going better safe than sorry. It so happens that the president of the university, Mark Schlissel, is, of course, an immunologist. So that probably factors in as well. I get where they're coming from, but I also get where the university is coming from. So this is another in a long series of tough calls.
So the student athletes said in their statement that they tried their best to create social bubbles to prevent the spread of COVID. But, I mean, John, how many athletes are there at the U of M? How big would that bubble have to be?
There are about 900 or so varsity athletes. About two-thirds of them are scholarship. Not that that really matters in this case. The contagion does not care. But 900 student athletes, and again, there are Zoom classes, of course, so there are a lot of protocols here that do help. But there is interaction among them. So I see where the university is coming from. I get the frustration of the athletes, especially when they're probably playing it safe. But as I have heard elsewhere, of course, from the immunologists, when you do the thing right, it looks as though you're being too cautious. And you're doing it wrong, it looks like you're stupid. So those are your choices, looking too cautious or looking stupid, and those are not very appealing choices. But 900 student athletes with this highly contagious, you know, strain, if one of them goes to, you know, the baseball house or the field hockey house, then it's going to spread. So that's the concern.
Right. Now, you alluded to this, but we should note that this has a major impact on a whole bunch of athlete seasons, including the men's and women's basketball teams, which have just been on such a tear. I mean, recognizing that we're in a situation where no one really knows what the tournaments are going to look like this year, how does this affect the basketball team's hopes for tournament?
Not too negatively, I believe. If you're number four in the country, you're having a great season, obviously, and they're blowing teams out, the men's team is. So number four means you're still a number one seed. In other words, one of the top four teams in the nation. That's a lot of power. They're going to make the tournament. They might get bounced, you know, one or two notches below where they are now based on not playing four games coming up. But they should be in good shape. The limit is 13 games to make the tournament. Already the men's team is ahead. 14 games. The women's team is also, they're 10-1, only one loss. So they need to get a couple more games in there. That's a bit of concern. If this does spread, then they're in trouble. If it doesn't spread and it's 2 weeks, they should be okay. I got to tell you also, Naz Hillman scored 50 points last week. That is the most ever in the history of Michigan basketball, men's or women's. So that's the kind of year they're having. And of course, men's hockey is right there as well. So they should all be still okay for the tournaments. The next question, of course, is will the tournaments be okay? And that's a fair question.
Yeah. Obviously, a bit of a lesser concern compared with the impacts to health and life that we could be talking about, but definitely something that's on people's minds.
Hey, like I'm as big a sports fan as there is, but yeah, you got to draw a line somewhere, right? So,
meanwhile, John, in high school athletics, the criticism is just piling on to Governor Whitmer as sports continue to be a no-go, while she's simultaneously pushing Michigan schools to resume in-person learning by March 1st. What are you hearing from parents and from high school athletic departments about why they think that sports should resume?
The high school athletic departments that I've talked to and also read about have been relatively calm about this. They know that they're largely powerless in the situation. The parents have been less so, as you might have expected, and the athletes as well. And it's exactly what you described. It's the inconsistency of policies where the governor tends to become unpopular. If it's, you know, across the board, no school, no sports, it's easier to understand. If you're pushing to get them back into the schools by March, as we know, and yet not allowing the athletes to play, that's also an issue. But it has to be said, the overarching concern here, look, high school athletes, the rate of fatalities are extremely low. Likewise, college athletes, it's basically not happened. But that's not the concern from the health point of view, of course. The health concern is if this wild strain gets out in the community. My parents are 88 and 85. They live in Ann Arbor. So other people become targets. And then, of course, your hospitals are filled up yet again in the ICU units. So that's the real concern here. But it's the inconsistency with the school versus sports aspect that has the parents, not all, of course, but many parents frustrated and getting more and more vocal about it.
Well, on the bright side, at least it's cold enough that the kids can finally get out on the pond this winter.
Check the ice, people. Check the ice.
John Eubacon is Michigan Radio sports commentator. He's the author of many books, including Bo's Lasting Lessons and The Great Halifax Explosion. Thanks, John.
Thank you, April.
There are 8 confirmed cases of the B.1.1.7 variant of COVID-19 at the University of Michigan. With a student body that's prone to social engagement, how does a university fight the spread of this relatively unknown strain? Here to help us understand what they're up against is Dr. Preethi Malani, Chief Health Officer and Professor of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Dr. Malani, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, April.
Tell us what we know about what makes this variant of COVID-19 different.
Yeah, so we're still learning about this variant, but so far we do know that it spreads more easily and quickly. There's some debate about whether it might cause more severe disease, and I think that is unknown at this point. But just given that there's very little margin for error at this time with something that is more contagious, prevention takes on even more importance.
I know that we're just on the leading edge of all this, but are you treating B.1.1.7 as though it is more dangerous given the knowledge that we have at this moment?
I would say at this point, we are treating it as having more potential to spread. So in that sense, it is potentially more dangerous to the community because the idea that you could go from being kind of contained with COVID to being overwhelmed is a fine line. And actually, as a state, we've been doing well the last few weeks, really since November. And so we have to really keep our foot on the brake and get us to that next phase where we have enough people vaccinated.
The engine that started moving things forward was the fact that the Washtenaw County Health Department strongly recommended that the athletics program be shut down. Should people be concerned that the county is taking the lead on this? Why didn't the university act first?
Well, the county and the university work in sync. And again, I am thankfully not in the middle of that, but I just want to state clearly that there is a really strong partnership. And some of these recommendations are going to come from public health partnerships. So whether it's the state or the county working in sync with the university in this case, or it's the university making a decision, but really every decision around the public health approach, particularly anything dealing with what to do on campus in terms of like the previous stay-at-home order, for example, those are done hand-in-hand with the county. But I just want to emphasize that it really has been a partnership. And one of the concerns that is specific to athletics that maybe not everyone thinks about, but it makes sense, is that teams travel. And even across the Big Ten, that's 11 states, including ours. So, you know, those decisions are never made lightly. But one of the thoughts is to try to keep things contained while you can. And again, with variants, we might not know the extent of spread at this point because that sequencing isn't done routinely. And it feels like every day we're hearing more. I know yesterday there was a report of the Brazilian variant, which is also concerning, and that was seen in Minnesota.
We have seen over the course of the pandemic that the virus does tend to spread among college students who are in more social situations and perhaps taking fewer precautions given their age and their relative health. What are your concerns about a very transmittable strain of COVID starting in Michigan, you know, first presenting among the student body?
Well, it's always concerning because of the density of people, the way that people live. But I will say, and again, there's a lot of unknowns, but just anecdotally, and I know this because as a Michigan parent, you know, this is some of the things I hear, is that I know of several students who managed to do just fine all fall semester, but then went home to their families and inadvertently ended up becoming exposed and infected. So although there is this tendency to think that the students are all getting infected. Many of them didn't. So, you know, my hope is that they can double down on the prevention aspects. And I think a few things are a little bit harder this winter. One is if the variant is the predominant strain, and we don't know that yet, but there are modeling studies that suggest it will become the main strain maybe as soon as March. And that's nationally, not just in Michigan. And it's wintertime, and it's Michigan, so it's harder to be outdoors. So for the students, the messaging is, you know, really doubling down on the public health mitigation efforts that we know work. One of the biggest issues is the social gatherings. And I think, again, helping the students make good decisions, but finding ways to connect in smaller groups and doing that safely, being very diligent about mask wearing, wearing masks that fit well, making sure they cover your mouth and nose. What I would say with the variant is there's just less margin for error. That is what makes it a little bit different. Things that might have been okay in the fall maybe would be higher risk now.
You know, what do you say to students who are frustrated by being under restriction? You know, what do you say to them about why they have to carry on, if not completely, you know, locked down to a greater degree for the good of the community?
I think there's a range in terms of how the students are taking this, and it is very difficult. And I say this all the time, is that COVID is not the only risk to our health, to their health, certainly. And finding ways to connect safely is really important. So more than anything, what I see are groups of students in smaller groups, particularly their household, maybe a few other people. And a lot of the students chose to not be on campus this year and this semester. And I think that is a good decision for some people. Our residence halls are down to a very low capacity because we know that those settings, those group living situations, they can have a higher risk.
The university is also busy vaccinating folks. Is the main site still at the stadium?
The university is vaccinating folks. The main site is the stadium. It's set up well. And I think right now the limitation is really vaccines. There was a lot of vaccination that went on at the health system proper, but those were really for frontline employees. So I, for example, got my vaccination in the hospital, which was really convenient for me.
How many people is the university able to average on a day of vaccinations right now?
So right now, they're below capacity because they don't have vaccine. The number that I have heard is that they have capacity, if there's vaccine, to do upwards of 28,000 a week. But again, right now, it's a very small trickle of vaccine, and most of the vaccine that arrived this week is going to be second doses for healthcare workers. But I know there are about 1,000 first doses being given too. It's just a very small drop in the bucket because the estimates are a couple hundred thousand people that fall into that next group. But I'm hopeful that maybe in a week or two, things will improve with the supply.
Are you going forward with the understanding that the vaccine will be effective against the new variant?
Yeah, that's the hope, as has been the case really for the past year. And, you know, April, we were talking about how we spoke almost a year ago and really how different things have been with COVID. A day is like a week and a week is like a month. Everything is accelerated time-wise. But right now, the data that are available is that the vaccines will cover the variants, but new variants can develop. Variants can become potentially make it harder for vaccines to work and for treatments to work. All of this gets at the point that we are having to make decisions without all the information, which is, again, what we've been doing since the start. We have to pivot and be nimble. But the hope is the vaccines would remain effective at this time.
With all of the evolving changes that are happening right now, this variant, and you know, who knows what other ways in which the virus may be changing in the community, are you starting to think about the possibility of yearly COVID vaccinations for university students and staff, just the same way we think about flu shots?
Well, it's something that I have certainly thought about, but we're not there in terms of any kind of discussion. Right now, the focus is on the public health mitigation and then getting as many vaccines into as many people as possible. Again, I think this is something that nationally, there are efforts to develop more vaccine and manufacture more. And I'm hopeful we're going to be in a very different place in a few weeks and certainly in a few months. As to whether or not we'll need a yearly booster, or if variants will change and vaccines will change, this is completely unknown, but it's certainly possible. And then we'll have to talk about what that means for places like universities and schools where people are close together.
Dr. Malani, thank you very much for talking with us about this today.
Yeah, thank you. It was my pleasure to join you.
Dr. Preethi Malani is a professor of medicine at the University of Michigan, and she's also the school's chief health officer. And that's our show for today. I'm April Baer. I'll see you tonight online for Issues in Ale. Until then, thanks for listening.